First, let me explain who the panel members are. Frank Salisbury is director of the Plant Science Department at the State University of Utah. A noted biologist, he developed an early interest in the possibility of extraterrestrial life while working for his PhD at Caltech. I first encountered the name Frank Salisbury when I read a paper on the possibilities of life on Mars, which appeared in Science magazine in 1962. He was the author. I've been aware of Frank Salisbury then for the past 15 years. During the mid-1960s, a remarkable series of UFO sightings occurred in the Uinta, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, basin of Utah. Dr. Salisbury spent several years investigating the numerous sightings and authored the important study, The Utah UFO Display, which was published in 1974. Nearly all of you know Jim and Coral Lorenzen. They head the oldest UFO research group in the world, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, APRO, headquartered in Tucson, Arizona. They are two of the most respected figures in ufology. Now, their credentials have been read here before, but Jim was a member of the Kitt Peak National Observatory in Tucson, where he was senior technical associate. He designed computer interface for a remote control telescope and instrumentation for rocket elevated astronomical experiments. Coral has been editor of the APRO magazine, which many of you read. She has devoted her basic energies to the organization. Ted Boscher is a pioneering UFO researcher. He helped found Civilian Saucer Intelligence in New York, which was one of the first responsible UFO research groups in 1954. So he's been around quite a while, too. He's been an active figure in ufology for the past 25 years and is author of the monumental report, The UFO Wave of 1947. He has co-authored and edited a number of important works, including U.S. Air Force Projects Grudge and Blue Book Reports, 1951 to 1953. He currently works with the Center of UFO Studies and is compiling HumCat, a computer catalog of 1,500 UFO occupant reports. I'm going to kick this off with a viewpoint which has been pretty much constant with the editors of Fade magazine since it was founded 29 years ago. It may be the most unpopular viewpoint here, but I'm leading off first so that you or anyone else can take some pot shots at me if you want later on when we have our open forum. On Fate magazine, we have covered many of the well-known UFO contactee events, but we have always felt extremely uneasy and wary of them, particularly those claims involving humans or humanoids. In most cases, especially in the early days, if the claim involved a purported human-like entity, we did not report it at any length, or we ignored it altogether. In view of the fact that Fate has become an historical record available on microfilm and in many libraries, I rather regret this now, but I do remain skeptical of all humanoid claims. I want to make clear that I am not critical of the reports of humanoids per se, but I feel they must be subjected to other interpretations than that human-like creatures visit us from somewhere else. Obviously, I cannot advance convincing proof for a negative viewpoint. Therefore, I have to fall back on what I admit might be termed common sense mixed with a bit of prejudice. My main argument is as follows. First, that the very diversity of life on Earth is so enormously complex that the chances of a superior population in any way resembling humans coming from somewhere else at this precise moment in time seems less likely than beating the slots at Las Vegas. I'm not arguing against the extraterrestrial theory of UFOs, although I believe that is only one of a number of arguable hypotheses. But I am saying that if extraterrestrial life exists, it cannot be humanoid. My second argument centers on the evolutionary development of life on Earth, which had to adapt to our planet's unique environment and history. Even given near infinity, can one imagine exact parallels of environment, history, chance, and time occurring on another planet? Can they? I don't think so. Thirdly, I want to examine the evolution of our immune system, which keep us alive, but which, in my view, could not have developed similarly in any space visitor. Our greatest enemies on this Earth are the billions upon billions of microscopic creatures and plants, hell-bent to destroy us and posing an even greater threat to unwary extraterrestrials. And fourth, I want to discuss briefly that part of man's psyche which insists on seeing life elsewhere as merely another version of our own life on Earth. It is part of our psychological outlook to imagine life elsewhere as not being too different from life here. First, let's step outside ourselves and look at life here. Consider its diversity. Birds, fish, plants, octopi, tardigrades, bacteria, viruses, if you can call viruses life, fungi, insects, coral, crustaceans, the whole mammalian kingdom, from tiny shrews to the giant cetaceans, to elephants, to man himself. If we assume Earth to be 4 billion years old, and it may be twice that age, man has been around in recognizable form for less than 1,000th of that span of time, and has been able to write for little more than 1 millionth of that total. A way to look at the problem of timing is dramatized by Carl Sagan in his book, The Dragons of Eden, Speculation on the Evolution of Human Intelligence. Sagan says, let's assume that the age of the Earth is a single year beginning on January 1st. Then life began on Earth about 9 months later. Life began 9 months later, or almost 10 months later, around September 25th. The human species, however, in this imaginary year, did not make its appearance until around 10:30 p.m. on December 31st, only an hour and a half ago, and recorded human history has existed only for the last 10 seconds of this imaginary cosmic year. The extraterrestrial humanoid hypothesis asks us to believe that in this tiny window of time, a mere spark in the black abysses of all the time that has been, our humanoid brothers from somewhere else have somehow found us and made contact. This would be a mighty coincidence indeed. Next, I want to explore in somewhat more detail what we know of the origins of life on Earth, out of which has grown the fantastic diversity of our terrestrial life. In very simple terms, as far as we are able to trace life on Earth, the earliest forms were blue-green algae and bacteria. Once life began here, it barely changed in its first 2 billion years. This has been termed the age of blue-green algae. For the first 2 years to 5/6 of life's history, these unicells alone inhabited the Earth. The reason for this is that these primitive cells have life, but they do not have nuclei. They reproduce by budding and fissioning, and that's about all. They did not change. They did not evolve. I don't want to go into the detail on this, but apparently about 600 million years ago, an unlikely accident happened. We still don't know how. Cells with nuclei developed, and this resulted in the creation of sex. It is the biological function of sex to promote variability by mixing the genes of two or more individuals. Sex cells have half the chromosomes of normal body cells, and when two sex cells join, they produce a new individual. The original amount of genetic material is restored. For 2 billion years, as Stephen Jay Gould points out, algal mats remained algal mats. But the cells with nuclei made sex a reality. And less than 1 billion years later, here we are, people, cockroaches, seahorses, petunias, and crows. This is extremely unlikely, it seems to me, that an exactly similar development could have occurred anywhere else. One can assume that by statistical chance alone, there must be life out there. After all, we are looking at 1 billion billion suns. That life is likely to be older, or it's likely to be newer than life is here on Earth. But my main point is that although the forms that life takes may be infinite, the chances of evolution anywhere else duplicating the exact sequence which occurred here on Earth are infinitesimal. It might be argued that once established, life elsewhere would be bound to follow the same sequence it follows here. But again, I want to quote Gould, who says that, quotes, ontological records support no such interpretation. There has been no steady progress in the higher development of organic design. We have had instead vast stretches of little or no change and one evolutionary burst that created the entire system. That evolutionary burst is called the Cambrian explosion. In that fairly brief period, after the development of cells with nuclei, Earth life in nearly all of its basic forms evolved. That life filled our biosphere, air, land, and water. The entire system of complex life on Earth arose during about 10% of its history surrounding this Cambrian explosion of some 600 million years ago. Identical life were to develop here, we would have to assume on these other worlds an identical physical environment developing along an identical path on an identical time frame with that of Earth. Included in that, in the critical physical criteria, which would have to be identical, would be existence of a large moon, for example. Existence of a similar sized sun with similar composition, emitting similar rays at an equivalent distance. There would have to be similar atmospheric composition, similar amounts of water, similar gravity, similar magnetic fields, which may depend on the dynamic influence of our moon, and so on. Even when one looks at near infinity, this is a great deal to expect. This leads to my third major argument, that we are incredibly well adapted to Earth's stable environment, to its gravity, to the high oxygen content of its atmosphere, to its water and water vapor, to its rather stable temperatures, radiations, and other physical conditions, which we seldom consider exceptional because we are so used to them. But let's assume that creatures from somewhere else were to appear on Earth. Let's also assume that they developed in a physical environment identical with our own. They would then face the problem of our disease. H.G. Wells was not speculating idly when he pictures the Martian invaders of a peaceful countryside succumbing to an unknown disease. One is mindful of the following doggerel that deliciously depicts our own situation. And perhaps you've heard it. Big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them. And little fleas have other fleas. And so, ad infinitum. How true. There are more living creatures on every one of you than there are people on Earth. There are millions of bacteria, fungi, and viruses attacking each of you constantly with one simple and deadly purpose, to kill you. You survive because of your complex immune system that has been in parallel evolutionary development with humankind for hundreds of millions of years. Immunologists confirm that man's greatest enemies are these countless billions of microscopic and submicroscopic creatures engaged in a constant effort to destroy us. Once the chemistry of life developed, the various species of cells went to war with each other. And over these hundreds of millions of years, the best fitted survived and attacked, and the ones that failed, their remains can be found sometimes in a few fossils. The concentrations of the various salts in our bloodstreams, for example, is the same as it was when our cells learned to live in the seas hundreds of millions of years ago. Could visitors from somewhere else have experienced this identical environment? It is said that a bacterium entering a cut in your finger can reach your brain in 4 seconds. In 24 hours, it can number billions. But over these same hundreds of millions of years that we have been developing, man has developed, for example, the white cells, the granulocytes, which eat or poison these bodily invaders. There are the macrophages, patrolling in our bloodstreams and carrying on their war against these lethal invaders. As I stand here, I have 150 billion granulocytes and macrophages available for combat, and I need them, for these bacteria are always trying to kill me. As a second part of our defense system, we have the antibodies, able to recognize anything foreign, to couple with the antigens, neutralize poisons, kill the microbes. A third part of our great system is a group of proteins called complements manufactured in our livers. The nine known complement components can literally explode through a hostile bacterial cell wall. And finally, we have the lymphocytes, which travel through our blood vessels in the lymphatic system or wander through the tissues themselves. Besides being killers of bacteria, they carry messages to alert the body factories to turn out more protective chemicals or proteins if they are needed to battle invaders. What are the chances of a space visitor would be equipped to handle these multitudes of deadly bacteria waiting literally to eat him up? Hundreds of millions of years of evolution, hundreds of millions of deaths, millions of lethal experiments were necessary before man or any earth animal developed the highly sophisticated and complex armament which I have described here and which is necessary to keep us alive. It seems unlikely to me that any space visitor exposed to this hostile environment could survive for 24 hours. We are enormously specialized in terms of evolutionary and development. In terms of space, we live in a micro environment where the very smallest change in the gross scale of interstellar distances, space, time, and temperatures would destroy us. If this is true of us, is it wrong to believe it also would be true of visitors? And if it is not true of them, then we have to assume that they are not humanoid. As a final part of this discussion, I want to ask why we tend to regard visitors as humanoid. After I had selected this topic and written two drafts of the foregoing discussion, I was both heartened and dismayed to note that the lead paper in the June 10 issue of Science, Journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, covered much the same ground and arrived at much the same conclusion. François Jacob, professor of cell genetics at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, France, wrote, "When looking at present-day science fiction books, one is struck by the same phenomenon. The abominable animals that hunt the poor astronaut lost on a distant planet are products of recombinations between the organisms living on Earth. The creatures coming from outer space to explore the Earth are depicted in the likeness of man. You can watch them emerging from their unidentified flying objects. They are vertebrates, mammals without any doubt, walking erect. The only variation concerned body size and number of eyes. Generally, these creatures have larger skulls than humans to suggest bigger brains, and sometimes one or two radio antennae on the head to suggest very sophisticated sense organs. The surprising point here again is what is considered possible. It is the idea, more than 100 years after Darwin, that if life occurs anywhere, it is bound to produce animals not too different from terrestrial ones, and above all, to evolve something like man. Jacob believes that we humans create humanoids because we have to put order in the universe. We have to develop a unified and coherent view of the world and of the forces that run it. In my own view, even though we are surrounded by incredibly different life forms, we are simply unable to imagine anything much different from what we are familiar with. We combine bits and pieces, but all these bits and pieces are familiar. We simply cannot imagine things that are totally unfamiliar, any more than we could have understood before the development of liquid-fueled rockets that there could be such a creature on Earth as the bombardier beetle mixing spontaneously combustible fluids in an explosive chamber located in its abdomen. But the bombardier beetle does exist. That's another story. At any rate, at the conclusion of a much more complex argument than I have ventured to offer here, Francois Jacob says, the probability is practically zero that living systems, which might well exist elsewhere in the cosmos, would have evolved into something like human beings. Even if life in outer space uses the same material as on Earth, even if the environment is not too different from ours, even if the nature of life and its chemistry strongly limits the way to fulfill certain functions, the sequence of historical opportunities there could not be the same as here. A different play has to be performed by different actors. Despite science fiction, Martians cannot look like us. And if they cannot, then obviously we have to take a fresh new look at a multitude of UFO claims. Dr. Frank Salisbury will be next on the panel.
Mr. Fuller has done an absolutely superb job of stating the establishment approach to this question, and I would like to respond to it a bit. I don't know exactly what approach to take because the one that I had written down here is pretty much what he said, a lot of it. I think it's important to note that there is a bit of an alternative that's been suggested in the scientific literature. Robert Beery published an article many years ago in which he talked about the adaptive nature of the human form. It makes sense, I suppose, to have the brain up off the ground, to have stereo vision, to have some kind of arms that you can manipulate, hands that you can manipulate with, that you don't depend upon for walking. Many of the features of the human form, it can be argued, are adaptive, and there's selective value for those features. And therefore, it's conceivable that given the kind of random evolutionary processes that have gone on, that the general features of the human form might be a result. That can be argued. It's an unpopular scientific idea in establishment biology, but it's an idea that can be presented. I think there are some even more unpopular ideas that need to be thought about. Before I get to them, though, I'd like to continue the biology lesson that we've had this morning. In the last 30 years, perhaps, we have discovered a fantastic amount of information about what life is, how it functions, the actual nature of life. Most of the evolutionary theories, incidentally, were formulated before that, around the 1920s, early 1930s. The geneticists and the evolutionists finally got together by applying mathematics, namely population genetics, to modify Darwin's theory, introduce the concept of mutations, and produce what's referred to as the modern synthetic theory of evolution, or the neo-Darwinian theory, which says that, as Darwin said, features that are well adapted tend to survive because of the overproduction of young, which leads to a struggle for existence and a survival of the fittest. That there's variety within organisms, and this variety can be selected so that the parts of that variety that best enable an organism to reproduce its kind will tend to survive and the other will be eliminated. This was Darwin's theory, but what was added to it was the concept that the variety comes from genetic recombination, which Darwin didn't know about, and mutations, which Darwin definitely didn't know about. That's kind of the modern synthetic theory, and it'd take a couple of hours to do it justice. I'm hoping that you have some concept already. Since then, we have learned of the fantastic complexity of living things. It's absolutely spectacular, and it saddens my heart that the public in general remains sort of unaware of these things, only aware at a level that doesn't really allow proper appreciation. We've had some artistic achievements, we've had some technological achievements, and these are appreciated a bit by the public. But we've had these fantastic insights into the nature of life, and the reason they're not appreciated is that they require some background. You've got to learn about atoms and molecules and such things. Not many people in the public are willing to make the effort, I guess. Basically, we have learned that the basic unit of a living organism is the cell. We've known that for 300 years. For the last 100 years about, we began to get some insight into the complex chemistry that was going on within those cells. During the last 30 years, have finally really got close to it. We've understood the molecular structure of the enzymes. When I begin a biology class at Utah State University, where, incidentally, I'm not head of the plant science department. I wish that'd get... I keep forgetting to deny it. But it embarrasses me, because I resigned as head of the department in 1970, a whole 7 years ago, but it hangs on in some of these sources of biographical information. I'm a professor of plant physiology there, and not head of the department. Boy, how to get sidetracked. Anyway, I start to teach a class, and the students that come to the university have all had a course in high school biology, practically all of them, and so it's interesting to me to ask them, what's the most important thing in biology that you could learn? What's the nature of life? What is the really central concept of biology? And they never know, because they don't teach them that in high school classes for some silly reason that I've been unable to figure out. Mostly, I think, because even high school biology teachers don't like to learn about molecules. The central fact is that the metabolism, the chemistry of cells, is controlled by enzymes. Enzymes are protein molecules. No enzyme is known that's not a protein. Proteins are known that aren't enzymes, like your hair and your fingernails and skin and so on. But no enzyme is known that is not a protein molecule. In the last 15 years, learned about the structure of these protein molecules that are enzymes. We know of the structures of a couple of dozen of them, perhaps. It's a tremendous effort to find this out. But we can understand that the protein molecule that's an enzyme is a machine, that it does the kinds of things that Curtis was talking about, produces compounds, etc. The main thing that it does is interact with the substrate by having the substrate sit down on its surface. And the exact structure of that surface matches the structure of the substrate so that the two fit like a lock and a key and a lock. And this allows the reaction to take place. The enzyme maybe bends a little, puts a little tension on part of the substrate molecule so that the substrate molecule breaks apart, or maybe it pushes two substrate molecules together in a way that they can react faster. The reactions are all thermodynamically possible, it turns out, but what the enzyme does is make them happen much faster. And that's the fundamental nature of life. Well, the complexity of these enzyme molecules is really something to comprehend. How can you account for the production of this complexity by the modern synthetic theory of evolution, I have been asking myself for the last several years? I want to tell you one little story, and it has two conclusions. Let's think of writing a sentence from Shakespeare. Now, this is very comparable to putting together the amino acids in a chain to make an enzyme function. The sentence that I thought about and worked with was, "This above all, to the known self be true." I think I can remember enough of the figures to tell you the story. It has about 45 characters, I believe. And in the alphabet that I used, I let there be 30 letters, namely the letters of the English alphabet plus a space between words plus some punctuation so that we can punctuate the sentence. How are you going to write this sentence by some kind of chance process? You can let monkeys pound away at typewriters, or you can blow up a print shop and look for the type in the street. Best way to do it, I suppose, is to let a computer rearrange letters in a sentence. Computer will rearrange letters in a sentence and compare the sentences that are produced with the sentence that we're going to write. I mentally build a little computer, 1 liter in volume. And I let it rearrange letters in the sentence a trillion times per second. And I turned it on and I could see I wasn't getting anywhere. I wasn't going to be able to write the sentence very quickly that way. So I made enough computers of that size and volume to cover the whole Earth to a depth of about 1.6 miles, 2 kilometers. And I programmed each computer so that each one would write the sentence differently. I still wasn't getting there. So I covered all the planets in the universe with computers, about 10 to the 20th planets, 1 and 20 zeros worth of planets, 2 kilometers deep with my computers. No two computers writing the same sentence ever. I turned them on at time zero, and I let them run for 4.5 billion years, about the age of the Earth, each one writing a trillion sentences per second. Well, I got the job done finally. Once, somewhere in the universe, during that time, I wrote, "This above all, to the known self be true." Could be done, you see. You can consider that a human cell contains 23 sets of chromosomes, that each chromosome has perhaps several thousand genes, and that each gene controls the production of one enzyme. Now, to make any one of those genes, by a chance process, you're facing the odds that I just indicated in my little computer study. And if you want to know how many sentences with 40 letters you can write, all you have to do is multiply 30 by itself 40 times. I mean, for each letter, you can combine it with all the other letters. And each time you add a letter, you multiply by 30. So multiply 30 times 30 times 30 40 times, and you begin to, well, you get the exact figure of how many sentences you can write with 40 letters in them using a 30-letter alphabet. Those are the kind of things that biologists know about a bit. They're the kind of things that Kurt was talking about. And they lead biologists like Loren Isley. I went back a ways. He wrote his book, The Immense Journey, in 1957, a beautiful poetical book about biology. He's an anthropologist. He has a chapter in there entitled Flying Saucers and Little Men, or something like that. And the conclusion is that life, even cellular life, may exist out yonder in the dark. But high or low in nature, it will not wear the shape of a man. Nowhere in all space on 1,000 worlds will there be men to share our loneliness. George Gaylord Simpson wrote an article in Science in 1964 in which he used the same kind of an argument to arrive at the same conclusion. I think that there's no question that from the standpoint of establishment biology, there are no humans anywhere but on Earth. Now, whether or not they might be humanoid in the sense that it makes some sense, there would be selective value in having your senses up off the ground, having stereo vision, having arms that you don't walk on with opposable fingers and thumbs that you can manipulate instruments when you build your spaceship, etc. That could maybe be argued. But it's inconceivable, absolutely beyond any kind of establishment biological understanding of things, to imagine that you could get humans with which you could reproduce, interact biologically in that way. That's the one side of the argument. I think there are some alternatives. To begin with, we wouldn't be surprised if beings on other worlds were made up of the same basic kinds of chemical molecules that we are. Sugars, amino acids, nucleotides, fats, and so on. And the reason that we say that is that when we try to duplicate the primeval conditions on Earth, as it's suspected they must have existed, when we mix a reducing atmosphere of methane and hydrogen and ammonia and carbon dioxide and so on in a flask and introduce an energy source like electric sparks or ultraviolet light or just plain heat, throw in a little phosphate sometimes, what happens is that we do get the basic molecules upon which life as we know it is based. We get amino acids and protein, we get amino acids and nucleotides and sugars and fats and those kind of things. And we can even get the amino acids to hook together to make proteins. But there is where you run up against the statistical argument that I've been mentioning. To get the amino acids to hook together in the same arrangements that would produce the kind of life as we know it is absolutely fantastic. Very simple protein is insulin. It has, as I remember, 63 amino acids. That would be about the same complexity. There are 20 kinds of amino acids, so the alphabet is 20. That would be about the same complexity as writing this above all to the known self be true. Maybe a little bit more complex. What all this has led me to think is that maybe the modern synthetic theory of evolution is not true. I think that we run up against some real problems if we're going to account for mankind as we see mankind at this time. If we're going to account for I wish I had that list of things that Kurt mentioned. That's great. Yeast and tigers and violets and all those kind of things. If we're going to account for all those different kinds of living things, I think we've got a real problem in terms of establishment biology. I think establishment biology is going to have to reestablish a little bit and to get some other ideas about how things work. In the meantime, there are a couple of alternatives. If it turns out that when we look at UFO accounts, when we see the occupant accounts that Ted Blitzer talked about last night, when we look at the evidence of whether or not UFO occupants may be humanoid, and it seems to be overwhelming that they are, then we're entitled to wonder about what's going on here. Entitled to wonder whether the conclusions based upon establishment biology are really all that valid. Couple of possibilities. One is that God was in charge. It says in Genesis that man was created in God's image. That is, that there was an intelligent creation, engineering of life as we know it. That's the religious alternative, I guess. I like that alternative, but for reasons that I can't argue in a scientific sense. Nonetheless, if that's one of the alternatives, then it's conceivable that man was created in God's image on other planets. That's the religious alternative. A science fiction type alternative is that life and man were placed here by intelligent beings from other worlds. And I think you can maybe see that's a closely analogous argument to the argument that God was in charge. It becomes a matter of a definition of who's God and so on. And I find that troubling and worthy of a great deal of thought. But anyhow, it's conceivable that we're not all unrelated, that we didn't evolve independently. I think it's absolutely clear that if the villus boas and other such instances have any validity, if there's the conceivable possibility that man could mate with a being from another world, then we didn't evolve independently. Establishment biology, assuming independent evolution, absolutely eliminates that possibility. There's no way to consider it. The only way that you can have UFO occupants, not only humanoid, but also human, is to say that we had some kind of common origin, either in the mind of God or on some other planet seated then throughout the universe, etc. That's the main thing that I would want to say. Kurt mentioned the problem of contamination, bacteria. I think there's probably another side to that problem too. And the other side is that we don't yet really understand the interaction between a host and its parasite. We don't really understand at this time what disease really is. I was chairman of a committee to consider exobiology and what they ought to do with the Lunar Receiving Laboratory after the moon program was over. The Lunar Receiving Laboratory was built at a cost of about $18 million, as I remember, at Houston in Texas, just in case there might be organisms on the moon. Nobody believed that there were. Science had no reason to expect organisms on the moon, but the possibilities seemed so frightening that they spent $18 million to build this laboratory where the astronauts were brought after they got back from the moon, spent 2 or 3 weeks in isolation, you'll remember, so that if something began to develop in them, we wouldn't turn it loose on the Earth at large. And actually, it could have got loose several times when the thing landed and all. It was very scary as we look back at all this. There weren't any organisms on the moon. It was just as everybody expected. But it made us think about this possibility of contamination, disease organisms from another world, or are disease organisms contaminating another world. And I guess the conclusion that I arrived at after listening to many expert witnesses testify is that we don't know the answer to that one either. Not only is there a very intricate defense mechanism against individual organisms on Earth, but apparently organisms that infect other organisms have something very specific about them too. In plant pathology, the really amazing thing is that a given plant pathogen only infects a very small number of hosts. There are about 300,000 different species of flowering plants. Any given fungus that's a plant pathogen infects at most a half a dozen of those. Why doesn't it infect all the rest? Either because all the rest have some kind of defense, or because the disease organism does not have the ability to... It's not specifically matched to any host. And if the second possibility is right, then the chances are good that a totally alien organism would not be infected at all. I mean, it's an opposite kind of a conclusion to the H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds conclusion. And until we learn more about disease, we can't say for positive. Either possibility seems to be likely at this time. Well, okay. Biology maybe has something to contribute to all this. I think that, as far as I'm concerned, I'm happy to toy with the questions of did God create men in His image on other planets? If so, what does it mean to all of us here? Are they allowed to visit us? Are the visitations really something else than what we think they are? Are they part of the display that's being put on to mislead us, perhaps, or what? Many, many things, and I better sit down. Thanks.
My statement has to be very short and brief by necessity, because I'm completely unqualified to discuss the theoretical possibilities that are inherent in the discussion. I have no background that permits me to speak with any kind of authority on it. I can make the point that what essentially we're dealing with here, or what I'm dealing with, is a clutch of cases, 1,500 approximately, in which we have reports stating that creatures coming from UFOs, by and large, are reported overwhelmingly to be humanoid in appearance. And my concern has to be limited to trying to account for that. And the theoretical discussion is beyond my own ken. If it can be applied in terms of the actual data that we have on hand, perhaps I might be able to contribute something of some sort of value to that. I don't know if intelligent creatures in outer space can or cannot be humanoid. I personally don't know if this is really the issue at hand. As far as I'm concerned, the issue at hand is how do we account for humanoid reports in our own files. I think that this points out a very important factor of this whole UFO humanoid problem, and it's the problem of dealing with belief systems. We seem to be keyed, locked in a way, to the idea that the source for UFO reports must be extraterrestrial. I was for a long time, but I saw the light somewhere. I don't know that this is, it's not inoperative by any means, or I don't feel that at this point it's inoperative as a hypothesis, but it has been made increasingly clear to me over the past couple of years that there must be alternatives, because I think the theoretical arguments raised by Mr. Fuller are legitimate, and I don't know how to account for them. I can't, because I'm not qualified. But we are faced with a clutch of cases where the predominant description is of a humanoid entity. But I don't think that we should lock ourselves into the belief system that it must be representative of an extraterrestrial hypothesis, which is not to say that it is not. However, there are other possibilities. The reason that we may be getting so many humanoid entities is a kind of external imposition of an anthropomorphic interpretation of what something should look like, or what we would prefer it to look like if the scenario that's taking place is to be interpreted in its roughly reported terms, is much easier to conceive of a bizarre, strange experience in terms of what we're familiar with. I think this suggests very strongly the problem that we're faced is not are they extraterrestrial, but is what is going on here simulated by something external going on, or is there a possibility that some mechanism is at work interiorly in the human consciousness that is creating these manifestations? And are they merely an externalization of some psychological or sociological mechanism about which we know very little at this point? That's as much as I can say on it.
Paolo Lorenzo will comment on this.
Yeah, I'm at a distinct disadvantage because I'm a maverick. When I started looking at UFO reports, I looked at the reports and let them teach me. I always thought that there would be some real monsters if occupants did manifest themselves. And when the humanoids came along, I couldn't believe. I just couldn't believe. I still don't know if I believe, but I still say, people are seeing them, they exist.
Jim, do you want to talk from this, or do you want to talk from up here?
I'll have to cop sort of the same plea that Ted did and say that I'm not qualified to enter into a biological argument concerning biological theory. In trying to assess my own qualifications, I find that I have some technical background, but in approaching this subject under discussion, I'm approaching it entirely as a layman, and as an empiricist, and I guess I look at myself in a way as a sort of an obscure philosopher, known mainly for my obscurity. My approach to this, I say, is as an empiricist. And I find the arguments against humanoids very persuasive. However, arguments and statistics can be misleading sometimes, and I'll just give an example. I live in Tucson, Arizona, and suppose that someone would come to me now and say that they have reason to believe that my house has just been burglarized. If that idea doesn't appeal to me, I can resort to a lot of statistics, and I can convince myself that it hasn't been burglarized, because I can take the number of houses and the frequency with which burglaries occur in Tucson, and the diligence of the police in patrolling and various things of that sort. And I can show that the chances are so remote that I need to concern myself about it. But I would say that the best way to check on that is to go home and look. That's the approach of an empiricist. And that's the approach that I've taken in dealing with UFO occupant reports. Here we have an opportunity to investigate a phenomenon and decide on the basis of evidence as best we can whether or not it's really occurring. And I'm not going to say that it's clear, but just one more reference theorizing, it's a time-honored way of avoiding a problem that you don't want. But I doubt that theorizing would be very satisfactory to Travis Walton, for example. So I think that my contribution to this discussion today will be to discuss two cases that I've investigated personally that support each other in quite a remarkable way. First case I'll discuss involves Sergeant Charles Moody, who is a tech sergeant in the Air Force. He was stationed at Holloman Air Force Base at Alamogordo, New Mexico. And in 1975, in the month of August, I believe it was August 13th, he, working swing shift at the base, was not tired on returning home one evening, and he had heard that day about meteor showers that were supposed to occur, so he thought he'd go out to the edge of town and watch for meteors. He went out and parked in an area that's quite isolated from the city, even though it's nearby. It's isolated by some ridges and desert growth. He sat on the fender of his automobile for a while, smoked a cigarette, and watched, and he saw a few meteors. Then abruptly, he saw a disc drop out of the sky, and he's describing this to me. He said, it wobbled a little like an uncaged gyro, and then it caged, he says, and then it made a humming sound and moved slowly toward me. Now, Moody was a fellow who never believed this sort of thing could happen. In fact, he told me that he had been on several inquiry boards investigating UFO incidents in the Air Force, and he'd helped railroad a few people into some severe statements of charges that had lost pilots that had lost aircraft in UFO encounters. And he said that the coaching and the training he'd received just didn't prepare him to accept the reality of this sort of thing. So he was quite surprised. That's putting it mildly. He jumped off the fender of his car and jumped into it and tried to start it, and it wouldn't start. The dome light didn't even come on. The electrical system seemed to be dead. Then his next memory was to see the UFO flying away. The disc was moving off, elevating into the sky and disappearing. And he was feeling very numb, like his whole body was asleep. He started his car then. It started easily. He went home. Checking his watch on the way, he realized he'd lost an hour and a half. Came into his house. His wife was looking at him quite strangely. She told me at the time that she wondered where he'd been, naturally. And he came in looking quite pale, and said, "You'll never believe what happened to me." And she said, "Well, you'd better try me." But in the course of time following this incident, Sergeant Moody got in touch with APRO privately. He did not want to make a public report. Felt that it would have severe effects on his future as an Air Force career man. So we investigated the case quietly, put him in touch with Dr. Harder by telephone, and made some tentative arrangements for some regressive hypnosis. In the meantime, Moody got in touch with an acquaintance of him, of his, that he'd known for quite a few years, a retired flight surgeon, retired from the Air Force. And this man told him how to practice this, over the telephone, how to practice a sort of self-hypnosis and meditation that might help restore his memory for the lost time. There are quite a few details to this case. Moody had an injured back when he came out of this incident, and after a couple of days he broke out in a rash all over his body, covered from roughly middle chest area to his knees. He went on sick call and was sent to, referred to William Beaumont Army Hospital, where they treated him for a dose of radiation. They gave him the standard treatment, and it caused a little excitement because no one could figure out where he got this radiation, since he did not tell them of the experience. The only conclusion they could come to that there was radioactive material stored near the service line, and it was used in conjunction with magnetron grids that were charged with this radioactive material. There was supporting physical evidence for his story. It wasn't simply something that could have been dreamed up entirely. After receiving the standard treatment for a dose of radiation and he was returned to duty, he began to call me periodically. I would call him. But one thing that I advised him against was using the phone at the airbase, but he did use what in effect is the military Watts line from operations during the evenings. And very shortly, there was sort of a prophecy that I had made that became fulfilled. When I first talked to Moody, he said he said, "What do you suppose would happen if I reported to my superiors on this?" And I said, "The first thing I think that would happen is you'd receive shipping orders." So one evening, Moody called me and said, "Guess what? I'm being shipped." So I feel that probably the phone is monitored, because he certainly wasn't due for overseas rotation. Should have had a couple of years by normal procedures at that base. Circumvented our plans to have him regressed hypnotically. The only way I got to interview him personally is National Enquirer eventually flew me to where he was located, and the story came out through the Enquirer because of the help we had in this way. We were able to subject his testimony to psychological stress evaluation, which supported the truthfulness of his account. He remembered occupants, which he described as follows: that they weighed in the neighborhood of 100 pounds, he would guess, that they were under 5 feet tall, that they had large domed heads with no hair, not even eyebrows, that they had five-digit hands, but they had no fingernails, that they wore uniforms which were like coveralls that ended at the wrist and without a cuff, just simply terminated, and that they ended at the throat the same way, that they were very slender in build, with apparently very little chest capacity. Their mouths were essentially just a slit, that the nose was very, very small, that the ears were very small, that the eyes were frontally located like humans, but were very large. He reported also that the interior of the vehicle was dimly lit. He had trouble seeing, and he reported that it was quite warm. Before I got these details from Moody, which he wrote these details in a letter after he had recall. But before I received these details from him, I had made a trip to Phoenix, Arizona, to investigate the Travis Walton case. But I just want to go through where I feel that Walton's case supports Moody's and vice versa. I think the most you're familiar with the case, but briefly, Walton was with a crew of woodcutters. There were seven total, leaving the woods at sunset. They saw a disc-shaped object estimated variously from 15 to 20 feet above the terrain hovering in a clearing. Walton, deciding that this was the best chance he'd ever have to get a good look at one of these things, jumped out of the vehicle and ran up close to it. The other people reported that they saw him struck by a ray, a beam of some kind from the vehicle. He fell over. They panicked and left the scene. after recovering a little from their fright and thinking what they'd done, they looked at the vehicle, looked back, saw a lighted something elevate from the area and move off, and they mustered the courage to return and look for Travis, but he was not there. Considerable search was conducted over the next few days, involving around 50 people on foot, some on horseback, helicopters, and so on. Travis was not found. However, according to his account, he found himself on the roadway near Heber, Arizona, around 5 days and 6 hours later. He went to a phone booth, called his brother-in-law, they came and got him. He was taken by his brother to Phoenix, and I talked to him a couple of days later. Jim Harder joined us for that investigation. On the Saturday after Travis's return, he was regressed hypnotically, and he described the occupants that he'd seen. And every detail that I've given about Moody's occupants was described by Walton. Although Moody's case had never been published, and of course Walton's hadn't occurred, so neither one could have known of the other one's case. Now this is the sort of evidence that leads me to think we are dealing with real humanoids. I'd like to make a comment. Although neither man pointed this out, the type of humanoid they described is what you would expect to evolve in an environment where the atmosphere was somewhat dense, and you would not require large nostrils to breathe, you would not require a large chest capacity, you would not require large ears to hear, but if your light level was quite low, you would require large eyes to see. If the atmosphere was damp and warm, as the atmosphere was in these vehicles, you might have, one more item. They each described a very dry, white skin. The way it was, I think Moody described the skin as having the appearance of a white mushroom. And Walton mentioned something like marshmallows. These are the two cases, and this is the way they support each other. I find myself hard-pressed to account for them in any way except that they're being real occurrences that corroborate each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. We will entertain questions from the audience. Yes, sir, you.
Question is whether a two-legged, two-armed, one-head with stereo vision creature that gets out of a spaceship is to be called a humanoid or a biped. We're obviously talking about semantic things. To me, the term humanoid meant exactly what you said, that it's chemically, genetically, and in all the ways that we would think of relationship, they were not alike, but same general form appeared. The term human would imply that they're alike. And I think that the term humanoid was invented to show that they would be like the blackbird, but otherwise not alike. When you mention it, there are many cases of so-called parallel evolution known in the plant and animal kingdoms. I'm a botanist, and so I immediately think of the cacti of America and the Euphorbaceae of Africa, which have totally different kinds of flowers, and according to any scheme of classification would not be related, but which have the very same form. I mean, they have the same succulent with needles, etc., kind of a form. And that's the kind of an argument that people put forth to indicate that there could be humanoids, not humans, but humanoids on other planets that would not be related to us any more than much, much less than a cactus is related to a euphorb, but that might nevertheless have the same appearance. Now, I get hung up on a lot of these things. I guess that when you find yourself in UFO investigation, you find yourself in a situation to doubt all kinds of things. And probably for that reason, or maybe because of my basic personality that makes me doubt all kinds of things, I find myself in UFO investigation and also questioning establishment biology in terms of the basic theory of evolution. And I see some real problems. And the problems are exactly those problems of parallel evolution. you're up against the statistics that I tried to indicate in writing Shakespeare by chance. If you want to get things that are alike, and yet we see things alike in nature, and perhaps if the humanoids are as the Lorentzens and Ted Blurcher say, if the humanoids are really the fact of the matter, then we see these parallelisms, and the question is, where do they come from? I don't think establishment biology can account for such things. And consequently, there may be other possibilities. Intelligent creation or relationships among the stars. Passage between the stars for a long, long, long time. So that we're not only apparently the same features, but that we are indeed related. That's, I think, a possibility worth considering. The answer, boy, I don't know it. I wouldn't stand up here and say, I believe such and such, because I just don't have any idea how the answer is going to turn out. But I think those are the problems. I think I understand the problems a little better than I used to, and that's about as far as we are.
The question is, how do I recognize the obvious, the apparent technology of UFOs with my own position on the humanoid hypothesis? I don't deny that there are UFOs. I think every member of this panel believes, you know, but we don't know what UFOs are. If we assume they are machines, obviously they are a very high technology. The only point that I'm making, really, is that if they are extraterrestrial and if they are intelligently run and there are beings inside them, the chances of evolution are that they would not be humanoid. That's really the only point I'm making.
I don't think that's correct. They put a little moon dust in the culture media for several different kinds of plants. A guy by the name of Walkinshaw was in charge of it at this lunar receiving lab. That's one of the things they were trying to do to justify its continued existence. And some things grew lots better than the controls without the moon dust. And that was a bit exciting. I don't think there's necessarily anything mysterious about it. Plants and animals need trace elements, and apparently the moon dust had the right ones for certain species. I don't remember any results, although it's been lots of years, of the type that you mentioned where they wouldn't grow. What I remember is that a couple of ferns and mosses grew a lot better. Well, I don't think I want to get into the sons of God and the daughters of men. I think that's an obscure passage. I've thought about it a lot, too, though. I'll say that much. I don't know about many radiation cases. These are the experts. Ted, Jim, are there many radiation cases that you know of? I only know that one up in Canada, and you mentioned Sergeant Moody, maybe.
There are not very many radiation cases, but the symptoms seem to be quite clear. The effects of the electromagnetic energy are quite different from the effects of radiation residuals. And it's not likely they could be confused. That's about all I can say.
Well, but electromagnetic energy is radiation in the sense that there's a big old spectrum. And if you think of the particle way of looking at radiation, the photons, they start from way out in the radio end where the photons are extremely weak. And as you get shorter and shorter wavelengths, the photons become increasingly powerful. When you get to about the ultraviolet, the photons are powerful enough to begin to cause chemical changes in things that absorb them. When you get to the X-rays and the cosmic rays, they're even much more powerful. The kind of radiation given off by radioactive materials is usually that very powerful kind that causes lots of damage. Kinds of damage that are produced would be recognizable for a given part of the spectrum. That's what you were saying.
Yeah. Ultraviolet produces something similar to sunburn and so on.
Yeah.
We have time for one or two more questions. Yes, sir.
Okay, the question is, in the two cases I discussed, how did the percipients, or the victims, whatever you want to call them, how did they feel about the aliens? Is that it, essentially? Moody, well, to begin with, he felt like he was lethargic and he couldn't move very well, and he claimed a communication too, by the way, that one of them could communicate with him, in a way that he could not understand, but which suggests telepathy. He felt sort of an admiration and mixed with fear for them, was quite impressed with their technology and that sort of thing, and one of his remarks that he made to me was he couldn't understand why they picked him up, and he posed this as a question, and which they did not answer. But I'm digressing a little. Walton was simply unnerved by the whole experience and reacted violently as soon as he became conscious and saw that he was surrounded by aliens. He described as defensive moves. He found himself on a table, three aliens, two standing on his right and one on his left, the kind I've described. He jumped off the table and picked up what looked like a large glass test tube off a sort of a instrument table across the end of the room and tried to break it across the edge of the table to make a sharp instrument to defend himself. And the alien simply avoided him and left the room. But his reaction was fearful partly because when he slowly regained consciousness, he felt that he'd probably been injured. He could remember just approaching the vehicle and then feeling some kind of electric shock. And when his next conscious moment, he's on this table and he thought he was in a hospital. He'd been injured and he was in a hospital, regular Earth-type hospital. So on opening his eyes and seeing these aliens, he could be expected to be surprised and violent. Now, there were in his experience, he encountered other aliens. Well, I think they're aliens. They appeared to him to be human. And he looked to them for help to get him out of the situation because they looked human. But there were some things about them that suggested they might not be human. They resembled each other so much. There were four of them. They resembled each other so much that some people suggested they were clones. I don't go that far. I asked Travis specifically if they had differences, like, say, a difference in hairline, and he thought they had minor differences. But I think that's interesting psychologically. He reacted with fear and violence to the strange appearing ones, and he looked to those that appeared human for help.
We have time for one more question. Yes?
I'm not aware of any reports from Black Africa. There are several from South Africa that describe Caucasian-type humanoids, light-skinned. One of these is a contact case of which I suspect is probably rather dubious. I don't know for certain. There are a few cases of humanoid types with non-Caucasian type skin, and it varies from red-orange to brown. Some are described as black, but it's not certain whether this is a tight helmet or hood-like affair over the face through which the features are seen, or whether this is actual skin color. There are variants in the color. By and large, they're Caucasian, the large number of them, which suggests some very subjective interpretations to me. The majority of the reports come from Caucasians. But as far as I know, there are no actual Negroid-type humanoids that I am aware of. There are a few green-colored, there are a few red-orange, quite a few tan, deeply tanned types from, oddly enough, South America, or maybe not oddly enough, I don't know. But the tanned versions turn up in Nordic areas too, so it's really hard to make a generalization.
One more question. Whether anyone in this panel has considered the possibility that they may somehow be related to elves or leprechauns or something like that. Does anyone here care to speak to it?
As I mentioned briefly yesterday, there were three reports from 1976 of humanoid entities, two of them from Dunn, North Carolina, that were investigated quite thoroughly by the local newspaper editor who reported on the incident in Pursuit magazine, I believe the most recent issue, which is put out by Ivan Sanderson's group, SITU. And these entities in Dunn, North Carolina, were extremely reminiscent of the earth folk type of creature. They were under a foot tall, and they had the qualities of fairies rather than space travelers.
This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.